This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Macro Voices episode 73 was recorded on July 27th, 2017. I'm Eric Townsend. Author Chris Whalen will be joining me as this week's feature interview guest. Chris and I will discuss the U.S. dollar rally, the equity market outlook, treasury yields, the explosion of public and private debt around the world, and much, much more. But be sure to stay tuned after the feature interview when, at the request of one of our listeners, Patrick and I will discuss my own investment process and the subject of finding your edge as a trader. Now, please bear with us, folks. This one, again, ran a little bit longer than we expected, so this will be a long episode, but I hope that you'll find it worthwhile.
And I'm Patrick Ceresna. Now, Eric, let's talk about this S&P 500. I mean, what it really does show is the fact that we've gotten so used to low volatility that once we have a day that swings 25, 30 points, everyone's on edge. Right after lunch today, we had that plunge move from about the 2480 on the S&P down to about 2457 on those futures. And since then, we've recovered about 10 S&P points off the lows. What's your thinking here on the S&P?
Well, you know, I think what says more to me about this is the fact that when you have a down move that takes us all the way down to what was an all-time record high a week and a half ago, that really is not that big of a deal. When you have that kind of move that is only taking us back to where we were a week and a half ago and people are calling it a crash, you know, we've got, as you said, the situation where people have become so complacent and so used to no volatility. Now, I don't think this is it. I don't think that the crash is upon us, as so many people have predicted. I still think that although this market is ridiculously overvalued on any fundamental basis that makes sense for me, it's a waste of breath to even worry about that. The point is, despite the fact that we might be way overdue for a correction, what's the catalyst that's going to bring it about? We are seeing with moves like today that this market is jittery, that if there is a significant catalyst, it could really, really cause a move to the downside to happen very quickly and very violently. So I think it's a very good warning, this little hiccup that we had today. But I don't think this thing that, as far as I can tell, happened either without any proximal trigger or maybe Zero Hedge published something, I think, that said some guy wrote an article, an analyst someplace saying that the market was coming close to a turning point and the publication of that article might have triggered this. Okay, if people are freaking out over an article, how are they going to freak out when maybe something like the debt ceiling debate really gets ugly? And although I have been very quick in past years to fade the whole debt ceiling thing, I think that it's a lot of big hype and hoopla in Washington, and they create a lot of fear-mongering. But at the end of the day, nobody wants the government to fall apart and collapse. They end up raising the debt ceiling, and we continue on. It's just a matter of how much hysteria and hijinks and theatrics go on before it. Well, this time around, it's different because there really are, and I catch myself saying this time it's different, but the reason I think it really is different this time is for the first time that I can remember, there is a very, very large contingent of the U.S. Congress that would love to see some major crisis develop as long as it can be blamed on Donald Trump. So the idea that we get into a debt ceiling debate where people won't budge and we end up with a government shutdown or even a default, even if it's only a technical default on a treasury payment, that could cause a major, major panic reaction. And I think the willingness of politicians to take risk of something going horribly wrong is much higher now than it's been in past years. So do I think the market's going to crash next week? Probably not. It would make more sense to think that later on this year, as we look at seasonal history, normally it would be a high in August and then things get dicey with a lot of vol and September, and the crash comes in October and November. The thing is, there's so many people predicting that. Crashes don't usually happen when everybody's predicting them. So I don't know what's going to happen. As someone who would love to be short this market when it's time, what I'm crossing my fingers for is that a month from now, Patrick, we're looking at 2,600 on the S&P. That would be a parabolic rise, a pure vertical move up that would be a sell signal, because that would be your parabolic blow-off top in process. We don't see that. We saw what actually, to me, still looks like a strong, healthy, bullish chart, as much as I can't believe it.
All right, well, let's look on to that dollar index. Now, last week you said that there might be a basing at this 95 level, but you were still leaning toward a move lower, and that's exactly what we got. So congratulations on your good call there. What do you think's in store here next for the dollar?
Yeah, you know, we saw a low print last week of 93.45, and it looked like a really healthy bounce off of that, and maybe that was going to be the bottom for a while. Then, wow, the FOMC's inflation running below target comment seems to have been what the catalyst was for new lows. Touched 93 even on Wednesday evening. It's rebounding nicely now, almost to pre-Fed levels, looking at about 93.72 here on Thursday afternoon. So I'm going to be looking for Chris Whalen's views. Now, I should mention that that interview was taped before the FOMC minutes came out. But as far as my desire to buy this dip, you know, some technicians are saying S2 support is around 92. That would be the place to buy the dip. But I'm very hesitant to buy a bottom when I don't fully understand how we got here, because how do I know it's a bottom? And as I've said before, I'm looking for the expert who really has a cogent, secular bear view so that I can understand the opposite side of the argument before I look to buy this dip. What occurred to me, you know, I mentioned before that we'd had Mark Yusko on the program talking about a secular bearish view. The one I'd almost forgotten is Juliet DeClercq nailed this. When we interviewed her, I think we were at 102 spot something on the dollar index, and I couldn't believe it when she made a bear call, and it was not just a short-term pullback. She thought there would be a significant pullback. That's exactly what we've seen. I use that as an excuse to call Juliet this week, both to invite her back on the program this fall, but also to feel her out a little bit. Now, remember, Juliet's in that club with Raul Paul and Julian Brigden and these other people who are, you know, primarily advising institutions. They charge $40,000 or $50,000 a year for their advisory services, so they can't give it away for free without upsetting their institutional clients. But I felt her out as best as I could, and she told me she's telling her clients she'd already taken profits on her short U.S. dollar trade, but she's telling them to look for a bounce as an opportunity to get back in. And I thought this was fascinating. She ties it into a view about global liquidity. So she's saying, how is it possible that we haven't seen that risk-off moment yet that everybody is talking about, that everybody's predicting? And she thinks the answer is all about weakness in the U.S. dollar. That's what's allowing the risk-on equity environment to continue. She's saying when we do get the risk-off moment, it's going to result in easing and therefore more U.S. dollar weakness. Now, this is the first structural bear argument that really resonates and makes sense to me. So maybe I'm not going to jump at the chance to buy a 92 handle after all. I want to get Juliet back on the program as soon as we can, though, because she'll tell us more than she was willing to tell me if it's in an interview.
All right, Eric. Well, let's move on to crude oil. Now, I was looking for that overhead resistance in that 47-48, at least reject oil along this area. But yet, we now are decisively trading above that kind of overhead resistance and trading up to $49. What's your thinking here on crude?
Well, I said last week maybe one push up to a 48 handle, but I thought it would be a low 48 handle, and I thought we'd roll over at that point. We got up to that channel resistance line above 48, I think it's around 48.55 or so. On Tuesday's first OPEC jawboning in the morning and then API inventory, which was a huge, huge, massive drawdown that API forecast of more than 10 million barrels on Tuesday afternoon. That just caused the market to go screaming to the upside. When the DOE inventory came out on Wednesday morning, it wasn't quite the 10.2 that had been predicted by API, but it was still about three times analysts' expectations. The number came in at a 7.2 million barrel drawdown on inventories, Cushing, Oklahoma drawing down 1.7 million barrels. Gasoline, which API had anticipated a build, was a drawdown of 1 million barrels. Distillates drawing down 1.9 million barrels. So we've got big, big drawdowns across the board, obviously a very bullish signal for crude oil markets. That really brings the view that you and I have had into question. I really thought we were going to hit 48 or so. That was going to be the channel resistance line, and I thought we'd roll over from there. There's still room for that to play out, but we've seen a couple of daily closes now, Wednesday and Thursday, above that line, and it potentially portends higher prices. I think it will end if we look ahead. You know, summer driving season is ending. All of these big seasonal drawdowns in inventory are going to give way to seasonal builds on inventory. And I think that could be the trigger that we need. But we are seeing prices move higher than I thought they were going to. The rig count kind of stalled in the United States last week. We haven't seen this week's number yet because it comes out on Fridays at about noontime. But I think that, as Art Berman pointed out, the rig count stalling, it was actually down one last week in the U.S. It was up 15 in Canada. So, you know, I don't know why it's down one in the U.S., but it's offset. And I think in terms of global production, the rig count is still on the rise. The thing that seems to have really thrown a monkey wrench in the works this week is talk about Venezuelan oil sanctions coming into the game, that the Trump administration might seek to impose sanctions on the Venezuelan oil business. Now, it didn't make much sense to me when I heard this news. At first, I didn't think a whole lot of it because it didn't make sense to me that the U.S. would try to impose sanctions. You've got to remember now who we're talking about. It would not be that big of a deal if you were talking about very level-headed heads of state who react unemotionally without involving their egos in their decisions. We're talking, Patrick, about Nicolas Maduro and Donald Trump. The ego-free, level-headed thinking of actions here, I think, has spooked the market. I don't see this as big of a deal as the market seems to be taking it, but I think people are just like, okay, anything could happen here. And if the Trump administration did something that pushed Venezuela into a societal collapse, and remember, if you take sanctions against Iran or Russia, you're not going to push the entire nation into a societal collapse. Venezuela is so fragile right now. There's so much broken in that country that sanctions from the U.S. could literally push it over the edge into an outright collapse to the point where the oil business is shut down. I think the market is fearing that. I do think it is an outlier risk. I don't think it is the base case. The place where it's particularly putting a lot of pressure, Patrick, is on time spreads, where we were seeing a steepening of contango in the term structure. We've gone almost back to a flat term structure, especially through the latter half of 2018, since this Venezuela news came out. And I think the market is probably overreacting, or maybe they know something I don't. I'm not sure.
All right. Well, let's move on to gold here. And gold continues to pivot off of actually what I consider a very important technical level. This kind of 1250 to 1260 range on bullion seems to be the area where if it was going to reject, we could see it roll over here. And we're trading near 1260, right, as we're talking right now. What's your feeling on gold here?
The thing I was looking at, Patrick, when it was moving down last week was 1240 needed to hold in order for the bullish case to continue to dominate. Well, it did hold. And in fact, that 1242 or so, I think, was the low print on this recent cycle, was rejected very strongly. And we saw a big rally, got a big tailwind from Janet Yellen. And the comments about inflation running below expectations, I think, have helped it a lot. Of course, that help that it got from Yellen initially was faded. We saw a little bit of a retreat from that, but now we're building back into it. So this chart looks very bullish to me. We still need to get above 1300, though. You know, some people are actually saying the right shoulder of a head and shoulders is forming. Now, frankly, if I look at the so-called left shoulder, it's only about $5 below the head in this pattern that some people are seeing. I'm sure not. But I do agree that we need to see north of 1300 before you really confirm that the bullish move is on. So far, though, it's looking a lot more bullish and a lot stronger than I had expected a couple of weeks ago.
All right. And finally, I just wanted you to just comment quickly on the 10-year yield, which now is hovering around this 230 area. What's your thinking on interest rates here?
Patrick, I got the chance to ask Juliette Declercq about this week. She's taken profits on her long treasury trade, and she's no longer got the outlook that she did. I wasn't able to get a whole lot of context from her. We'll get her on the program at some point and go deeper into this. But, you know, we're still in this range of 212 to 240. I had been leaning towards the breakout happening on the low side rather than the high side. I'm back to the point now where I don't really have a view. I'm waiting to see what happens. But it'll be interesting in either case to see which way it goes.
Thanks for that market wrap, Eric. Now, before moving on, I'd like to ask a personal favor of our listeners. Now, we hit the top 100 list of the business podcasts on iTunes last week, and that's really helping drive our listener count. And as you know, the more listeners we have, the more I'm able to recruit the very best featured interview guests. And as a credential, like being in the top 100 list is a huge asset for me to use when negotiating with our most wanted interview guest staff. So this week, I'm asking for a personal favor for every one of our regular Macro Voices listeners. We're not charging money for our program, but we really do need your help. So please take a few minutes to rate and review us on iTunes. Your 5-star rating will keep us on the top 100 list, and that will help me recruit even better featured guests in the upcoming months. It only takes a few minutes. Just log into the iTunes store and look up the Macro Voices podcast in the search box, and then click on the blue square Macro Voices logo under the podcast's heading. From there, click on the ratings and reviews, and then click on write a review. The few minutes you spend writing a 5-star review will make a world of difference in my ability to bring you the very best feature interview guests in the coming months. So moving on, joining us as this week's interview guest is author Chris Whalen. Eric's interview with Chris is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me next on the program is author Chris Whalen. And Chris, thanks so much for joining us. I want to start with the U.S. dollar because, you know, we've had quite a few guests talking up a secular bullish argument on the dollar. And boy, it really all sounds very compelling. But look at the chart. The chart is telling us dollar bulls that we're wrong. So how do you see this playing out? What do you think is driving the weakness that we're seeing in the U.S. dollar? And does it represent a secular change in direction, or is this just a natural pullback in an ongoing bull market?
Well, you know, it's hard for analysts to get their hands around the dollar because the old relationships, particularly interest rates and trade balances, which used to give you a good idea of where a currency was going to go, don't seem to matter anymore. So the dollar was rising against major currencies after the financial crisis, and particularly over the last 4 or 5 years, in large part because people were fleeing whatever country they were in and going to the perceived safety of the United States. So Russian oligarchs, members of China's Communist Party, they sent trillions of dollars to the United States over the past 5 years. Much of it went into American real estate. They also like Canada, by the way, because both the U.S. and Canada protect property rights, and they have a reasonable degree of confidentiality when it comes to investment flows. So if you're a Communist Party cadre in China and you've stolen millions of dollars, you want a safe place to hide it. And so this capital flight contributed to the strength of the dollar, really apart from the normal considerations of trade deficits and interest rates and everything else. Now it's kind of reversing because there's been this narrative on Wall Street, particularly in among the private investment community too, that said, well, you know, places like Brazil, Europe, even Asia, even Japan are all of a sudden attractive. And so you've started to see money flowing out again. Whether it's going to be maintained or not, I don't know, because as I say, the old measures for whether a currency was going to appreciate or depreciate really have lost their validity since 2008.
I want to follow along with a question that may be related, maybe not. You know, a lot of the dollar bulls have argued that President Trump's repatriation agenda ought to drive further dollar strength. I know that you wrote an article recently about a Supreme Court case that I wasn't even aware of, having to do with a lot of U.S. corporations using offshore asset-backed security transactions effectively to avoid taxes. And you think that this Supreme Court case means that that's about to unwind. Give us the story there, because that's something that I had not heard until I heard about it from you. And then does that affect the dollar, or is it really independent of the dollar rally?
Well, the Supreme Court case involved Dow Chemical. There was also another case involving General Electric. And what happened was the Internal Revenue Service had looked at some transactions that both of these companies had done years ago, and they decided that the sale of assets that these companies claimed and the related reduction in their U.S. tax liability were essentially a fraud, and that the assets and the income were not proportionate. In other words, if you try and get rid of, say, $100 million worth of income, but you only move assets that are, you know, attributable to part of that revenue that you're claiming, the IRS looks at that. And they have limited resources, so they only get around to this slowly. There was another case involving a company called Overseas Shipholding Group, which you might want to look at. The company had to file bankruptcy after the IRS disallowed some of their offshore transactions. The money here is huge. We're talking about tens of trillions of dollars in taxes that have been avoided by U.S. corporations. So when the politicians like President Trump talk about repatriation of taxes, they're only talking about a tiny, tiny fraction of that. Meanwhile, though, the IRS is slowly looking at all of these offshore transactions, and now that the Supreme Court looked at it but declined to review it, the case now has national effect. And I think that companies that have used these sorts of tax shelters in the past basically are going to have to sue for peace when the IRS calls, because they won't have a basis for arguing. And interestingly enough, President Trump uses the same lawyers who were representing Dow Chemical. And his avoidance of taxes when the loan guarantees he had were forgiven in the restructuring of Trump casinos in Atlantic City is exactly the same situation. So think about that.
So that's very interesting. So President Trump potentially can threaten these companies and say, if you don't repatriate assets the way I want you to, I'm going to go after you because I know your lawyer is shady because he used to work for me.
Because I know him too. Yes. Well, yes, he could. And look, the IRS is one of those strange agencies. On the one hand, the Treasury needs them to keep everybody in line. But on the other hand, Republicans always love to starve the agency for resources because they really don't want them looking at every possible transaction. But suffice to say, there's a lot of money involved here. You know, the folks at Goldman Sachs and their structured finance team are very good at constructing tax shelters. And, you know, I think it's good that the IRS is looking at these things because in many cases they're fraudulent. And they really ought to be further taxes paid by these companies. It's not fair to American individuals and businesses that don't do business offshore if these large multinationals can get different treatment for their taxes.
Let's move on to the U.S. equity market. We've had a lot of people on the program arguing that the market is way overvalued. This thing is overdone. It just has to crash here. The top has to be in. Yet it continues to march higher. We've also heard the opposite argument, which is that there's so much new liquidity in the system in terms of the Fed supporting the market. Even if we're supposedly talking about shrinking the balance sheet now, it's shrinking it very slowly. Which way do you see this, or where do you think it's going? What's your outlook for short, medium, long term in the equity markets?
Equity markets are clearly overvalued. They're very much like what you see in the residential real estate market in the United States and also in commercial real estate. The Fed manipulated the credit markets. They took $4 trillion worth of securities out of the market, and they've essentially forced all of us to invest in something else. And so you've had a situation where low interest rates have driven money into stocks. You've also had companies buying back their stock because debt is so cheap. Look at IBM. They have a negative book value for the company now because they've levered up so much and bought back so much stock. And so you have a scarcity of supply. And so I would not disagree at all with your other guests that the stocks are overvalued. The street keeps coming up with rationales why that's not so, but I think it's clear that it is. But on the other hand, do I expect the market to crash? No, because remember, the constraint here is supply, and there's so much money looking to invest that it's going into all of the possible asset classes and in some cases into surreal asset classes like Bitcoin and all of these digital currencies. It's very much a function of the central banks. And I think that's a problem because when we quote-unquote normalize interest rates, we're going to see a lot of credit losses on the books of banks and bond investors because crappy companies were able to go out and borrow money like they were good companies, thanks to Janet Yellen. There is a cost to the social engineering that the Federal Reserve Board engages in. And, you know, I think it's going to, over time, the history is not going to be kind to Yellen and her colleagues because they have created the next problem. We just haven't gotten there yet.
I want to go a little bit deeper on this subject of corporate buybacks because I couldn't possibly agree more with you. And I know you've done a lot of work in this and written quite a bit about it, that, you know, corporations basically looking at the cheap credit market saying, you know, forget about what's good for our business. What's good for the executives is to pump the stock price up. Let's borrow a bunch of money, buy back our own shares. May not make business sense, but it makes sense for my pocket if I'm the CEO. You know, you just have to go back to the old adage of what could go wrong here. It seems to me a lot could go wrong, but what I can't get my head around, Chris, is how does this actually end? Because it seems to me like if we do see interest rates start to back up, they're going to back up slowly. There's still going to be more opportunity where we saw, you know, oh, bottom prices on money. Let's buy more stock. Well, now it's going to be a little bit more expensive. It's going to lead to let's do some more stock buybacks before it's too late. When does this eventually end, and what could happen?
One scenario I've been pondering is, you know, companies are not very good at predicting the movements of financial markets. They're very short-term in their thinking. And if interest rates were to rise significantly, let's say we got the 10-year bond up to 3.5%, 4%, which is a lot given where we are, companies might have to start rotating out of the debt that they incurred to buy back their stock and start issuing stock. In other words, they have those shares. They're sitting in treasury on the books of the company. They can reissue that stock and raise money, but they may be forced to do that at a price that's lower than the price they paid to buy the stock back, in which case they'll take a loss. So I think there are a number of scenarios that could unfold when you look at the balance sheet of corporate America and the huge amount of debt that they've taken on. But the one saving grace is that deflation is still a dominant tendency in the market today. So while the Fed can push short-term rates up, you know, by brute force in this case, the 10-year bond is still dropping. You know, mortgage rates have been falling for the last 2 months. And I think that the secular demand for paper, that hunger on the part of investors for what we call duration, which is another way of talking about the bond market, is quite profound. And I've been telling people, I think the 10-year treasury will go back to 2%, which is another half point in yield. That's a lot. So in the near term, I don't think that medium to long-term interest rates are going to go higher. The markets are very keen. Look at the last treasury auction. It went extremely well. They want the paper, but the real issue to me is why aren't these companies investing in their businesses instead of buying back their stock? You know, people always in the economics profession, they're always talking about how can we get companies to invest? How can we increase productivity, which is their big thing, obviously, because at the end of the day, growth is a function of population growth and how productive your workers are, how much is that increasing? And productivity hasn't been increasing in over a decade. It's flat. So that's why you're not seeing GDP growth much more than about, you know, 1.5%, 2% annually. That's not good because when you look at all the debt these countries have, public sector debt, they need to grow faster. You know, the low interest rate environment since 2008 was meant to help debtors. It was an explicit transfer from savers to debtors. And instead, all of these countries continued to go out and incur more debt. So, you know, we have a fundamental problem in our society with governments that can't live within their means. They can't say no to the voters because the politicians will get voted out of office. And private sector investors and companies have to live in this same environment. And that's, you know, that's a difficult thing going forward. I don't know how we're going to preserve value for our families and our future if governments are borrowing from everyone every day with no intention of repaying. There's not even a discussion of repaying. When I was a kid, $1 billion was a lot of money. Now nobody cares. They just kind of say, oh, well, it's okay. So I think that's really the issue. I'm not worried about a short-term crisis for companies that have, you know, levered up to buy back their stock. But if rates pop, you could see quite a scramble from corporate America to try and rebalance their capital structures, something, you know, back to something that makes more sense.
You made a couple of really excellent points I want to come back to in a minute, which was both bond yields as well as this explosion of private debt around the world. But before we leave equities, I also want to touch, you know, one of the arguments we've heard is that this is largely the so-called Trump rally about expectations in the market that seem to be based on Mr. Trump's campaign promises that he's going to reduce taxes and have a big infrastructure spend and all these things. It seems to me, and I know you follow politics more carefully than I do, it seems to me like we're kind of coming up to a moment where maybe the market's about to figure out that Donald Trump's personality may not be what sells Congress most effectively on actually doing these things. So do you think that this Trump reflation rally could maybe be in for a significant correction if there is a political realization that maybe Mr. Trump's agenda is not going to happen?
The Trump trade, or the Trump bump, as I like to call it, was certainly a factor behind the rally from, say, November on through March. And then I think most people in the marketplace realized that tax cuts and spending increases and all the rest of it were not going to really happen this year because the government is still pretty closely divided, the Senate in particular. And so what was interesting was during that period, the 10-year Treasury actually rose to 2.6% yield, but corporate bond spreads continued to tighten. It was rather extraordinary to see these two normally closely correlated relationships diverge that way. And what that told you was is that investors are still very, very hungry, very much a demanding paper, especially investment grade corporate bonds. But having said all that, you know, I don't expect the markets to sell off precipitously. You may see a 5 or 10% correction, but then they're all going to rush in and buy it again. I mean, if you really listen to managers and watch the financial media, that's all everybody's hoping for. They're looking for a 5 or 10% pullback so they can go in and buy more. So I think, you know, we're in a strange place where whether you're talking about home prices in affluent areas around the U.S., mostly on the periphery, or stocks or bonds, the buying pressure is so intense that any sell-off, I think, is going to be relatively transitory. And again, I think the Fed is the reason that the stock market has been going up. You know, you can attribute it to President Trump, but I think other than financials, like, you know, Bank America moved 60%+ in 4 months. That's not normal for a money center bank, but they did because, you know, they had been working very hard on trying to get their costs in line and clean up the mess from the crisis. So the stock rose very dramatically, and now it's at book value. Hooray. Okay? But there's not a lot of upside in financials because they're all pretty fully valued right now, if you look at their earnings and their revenue potential. A lot of the rest of the stock complex is the same way. There isn't a whole lot of upside potential unless you're willing to believe that earnings multiples and other indicators really are too conservative and that earnings will be better next year and thereafter. The Street always has wonderful earnings estimates in the out years, you know, and then they walk them back as the actual earnings are announced. We saw that with banks. When we started the year, banks were supposed to see earnings up 12% this year, which is extraordinary. Revenues are flat. And now we're talking 6 to 8%. So the analysts had to walk back their estimates before the second quarter earnings came out. It's a game. And I think, you know, as I say, the overall theme today in the markets is a scarcity of investable assets. And until that changes, I really don't see the prospects for a precipitous and sustained decline in stock prices or bond prices, for that matter. They're both correlated. You know, that's another relationship that's broken down. Stocks and bonds are now correlated. That shows you how extraordinary the situation is in the financial markets and how much the manipulation by the Fed has caused a breakdown of the normal indicators that you and I would normally use to look at the market.
Let's come back to Treasury yields, because obviously a little over a year ago, Jeff Gundlach made this big, profound announcement that the 35-year bond bull market was over, and that's it. The top is in on price, the bottom is in yield. It's all the other direction from here. We've heard quite a few views in the opposite direction. Lacey Hunt on this program made a very compelling argument that if you just look at the over-indebtedness of the world and of governments, it's impossible to get to what we think of as historically normal rates. Now, you just said a minute ago you definitely see a move back toward 2%. Does that mean that you think that Gundlach is right and this is just a correction towards 2%? Or do you think that the jury's still out on whether or not the 35-year bond bull market is over or not? Or how do you see this in the longer term?
Well, I think Gundlach is right, but he's way early. You know, in order for you to have a sell-off in the bond market and really see interest rates move higher, especially medium and longer term rates, that money has to have somewhere to go. There isn't an obvious outlet or venue for the funds that are currently invested in U.S. Treasuries, U.S. corporates, U.S. high yield debt. Where else is it going to go in the world? We've created so many pieces of paper with pictures of presidents on them that they all want a home and they all want a positive return. And you're right. The indebtedness of the world, especially the public indebtedness of countries, I think is the real driver behind central bank action. The reason is the dropping interest rates has ceased to be an effective way to get economies moving. You know, back in the 70s and the 80s, you dropped interest rates a point or two and the economy would increase quickly. Now there's nothing. In fact, there's an argument that says that deficit spending is actually bad for growth. It's almost like the old crowding out argument from economics, which had been dismissed long ago. So I think that the secular tendency of markets has not yet changed. You know, the hedge funds would love to go and make some money on a rising interest rate trade, and many of them have tried over the last couple of years, and they've all gotten annihilated. So I think people have to realize that the weight of debt and also the posture of all the major central banks is such that low interest rates are going to be with us for a while. And until you see a change in demand so that Treasury auctions are not as successful and yields, in fact, have to rise to attract investors, I really don't see that changing.
Let's move on to a closely related subject, which is the explosion of both public and private debt around the world. We had Professor Steve Keen on the program saying, look, you know, we've just got this exponential growth of private debt. Until something happens, you know, we can't ignore this. It's an exponential growth problem. We had a similar argument from Lacey Hunt, who said because of this explosion of debt, we're headed for basically turning Japanese, for secular stagnation. Now, you wrote a book called Inflated, back in 2010 with Nouriel Roubini. And in addition to talking about this growth of debt, you make, I think, what's a very profound point, which is whether it's responsible or reckless or good or bad, this behavior is culturally ingrained. People are used to borrowing and spending what I would argue is beyond their means. It's not likely to change. So if it's not likely to change, how does this eventually end? And I guess maybe we should start by give our listeners a quick rundown of what the book Inflated is about. And from there, you know, how do you see this exponential growth of private debt? It can't go on forever. How does it end?
Well, Inflated was a book where I tried to relate the financial history of the United States with the monetary history. In other words, the growth of central banks and banking in general. Historians tend to ignore economics. They kind of go off in separate silos, and economists do the same thing. A great example of that is, why do we have national banks? If you read the history books, it says that they were created to strengthen the currency. No, that has nothing to do with it. They were created to fund the Civil War, because when Abraham Lincoln took office, the government was broke. He didn't have an army. And most of the banks in the U.S. were state chartered, and they didn't want to support the war, especially the big banks up north. They did not support the Civil War at all because they didn't want their business to be disrupted. So Lincoln created banks that could essentially double leverage treasury debt that they held as an investment, and that gave them an advantage. And over time, that was another layer of leverage, if you will, that helped the U.S. economy grow. Later on, you get to World War One. Again, you had a strain on the banking system financing all of the sales of goods and armaments that were shipped off to Europe. And so we create the Federal Reserve System in 1913. And again, you could argue that that was to strengthen the currency and do a variety of other things. But what it also did was it enabled the U.S. to finance World War One. J.P. Morgan essentially made a market in dollars until they couldn't do so anymore. And then the Fed of New York under Ben Strong stepped in and picked up the ball. So inflated talks about layers of leverage. And in the 30s, same way, the Great Depression, you had a government that had no debt. And so they levered up to try and eventually deal with the Depression, and then you had World War II. World War II, again, you had almost no private capital formation in the U.S. It was all government. Government dominated everything, big banks, big corporations, and the U.S. government. So over time, what you see in the U.S. is that when the natural rate of growth is insufficient to meet everybody's demand for gratification today, credit is used to pull tomorrow's sale into today. And the great example of that is something we'll talk about more, but the difference between General Motors and Ford. Henry Ford ran his company on cash, didn't believe in credit, always wanted to push the cost of his product down, but he assumed people were going to pay cash for it. Alfred Sloan at General Motors, on the other hand, understood credit. He offered his customers credit. He also financed all of his inputs to make cars. So General Motors grew enormously, and much larger than Ford by World War II. And it was because they understood credit. They would pull that sale into today by giving the customer credit. And that's really an allegory for the entire U.S. economy in the modern age.
And what does that mean in terms of this massively growing trend of credit expansion, private debt expansion around the world? It can't go on forever. So does it eventually end with some kind of crisis or panic, or do we just get into a Japanese style of economic stagnation? What happens next?
In the case of the U.S., we've already crossed the Rubicon by having the Fed purchasing government debt. Other central banks have gone even further, and they've been purchasing private debt and even stocks. The Swiss National Bank, for example, has been purchasing stocks from all over the world. Same with the Bank of Japan. And I think ultimately, when you think about an asset, the question is, can it throw off enough cash flow to service the debt you have on it? So let's look at an apartment in New York City. Most high-end apartments in New York City cannot be rented for enough money to cover the debt you would need to buy it, say with 20-30% down. In fact, even if you put half of the cost of the apartment down as a down payment, you still couldn't generate positive cash flow. And in a classical sense, that tells you that the asset is not going to work and that eventually the debt has to be restructured. You're starting to see that. Now, with public sector debt, unfortunately, I think what will happen is that the central banks will buy it and monetize it. And that's a direct act of theft from investors, because instead of seeing interest rates rise when a government's credit comes into question, the central bank will just buy it and monetize it and essentially use inflation to get rid of the obligation for the government. And you're definitely going to see that in Europe. I think eventually you're going to see something even more grotesque in Japan, because they just don't have enough growth to catch up with the debt they have. The cash flow is insufficient. So the old classical measure of solvency, which is how much can I generate in income from an asset, is still very applicable. But the trouble is that the politicians and their enablers at the central banks are now willing to do anything. You know, as Mario Draghi at the European Central Bank said, "I will do whatever is necessary," and he sure will. He'll monetize all the problems of the European community. In part because he helped create them. If you look at the mess in Italy and their banking system, that's Mr. Draghi. And how ironic now that he's buying the debt of insolvent Italian banks using the collective funding from the European community. So I think there's a certain delusional aspect to what you see from our public officials today, because they look at the numbers and the numbers are so scary that they don't know what to do. And so they turn to the central banks and the central banks say, okay, we'll make it better. And that's what they've done. I mean, Janet Yellen has monetized trillions of dollars worth of U.S. Treasury bonds and also obligations from Fannie and Freddie and Ginnie Mae. And, you know, what's the point of this? Did it help growth? No. Not at all. It was a subsidy for the United States because now the U.S. government doesn't have to make good on those obligations. I think you'll see more of that.
There's an old joke among historians. You know, if you ask a historian, what's the most important lesson we can learn from studying history? They'll tell you the answer is people don't learn from studying history. And it seems to me there's an analog there, which is this demographics issue that I'm told, although I was not in the industry at the time, in the late 80s, if you went to an investment committee meeting and said, hey, here's an investment theme, Japan demographics, people would laugh you out of the room because we've heard that before. That's an old one. Everybody knows that. We're not going to take it seriously. And of course, what happened was people assumed it was priced in, and it wasn't priced in exactly as could have been predicted decades before. We got to the point where the aging Japanese population caused a major change in that economy. It seems to me, and I know that you're a historian, so I really am looking forward to your view on this, but it seems to me like we're repeating that chapter of history in the United States. Everybody is ignoring the fact that the baby boomers are turning 70 and that they're retiring and that we're getting to the point where all of the baby boomers will be retiring in the next few years. That has to lead to a pension crisis, I think. It has to lead to a lot of changes. And it seems like everybody just assumes it must be priced in since everybody knows about it. Do you think it's priced in? And what do you think could happen?
No, it's not priced in. You know, it's like the former CEO of Citigroup said, you're going to keep dancing till the music stops. And I think if you look at Illinois, if you look at Puerto Rico, if you look at the restructuring of General Motors and Chrysler, in each case, what you see is that the people who are in charge of these enterprises gave away a lot of benefits to their employees, pension benefits, health care, et cetera, et cetera. But given that the demographics in the country have slowed down, and instead of having 1.5 or 2% annual population growth, we have 0.5 today. And so you have fewer workers working to support all of those obligations that were made to their parents. And what will happen is that slowly over time, many of those promises are going to be repudiated. In fact, I would tell you, I think there's a good chance that General Motors will have to go through bankruptcy again just to deal with the continuing burden of supporting the benefits to United Auto Workers and the various other employees and companies that are dependent on General Motors, because the numbers still don't work. The whole restructuring of the U.S. economy that occurred from World War II on to today came about in part because many companies in the 50s, 60s, 70s were still running like they had cost-plus contracts from the federal government, and they still had the overhead and the employees and the benefits programs, but they didn't have that business anymore. And over time, they had to be rationalized. The aviation business and many other industrial businesses in the U.S. were really geared for war and for the wartime years. But once we were back in peacetime, they had to compete in many cases with countries that we had helped to rebuild. So, you know, the whole dynamic of the world is in a lot of ways back to where we were in the 1920s, when you had an oversupply of labor, you had extensive and increasing competition among nations in terms of trade flows. And a lot of people were very frustrated and even downhearted because they couldn't see a way forward to deliver the growth that people wanted to see, given the big factors, which are productivity and demographics. So what should we do? Well, we could go out and make a lot of babies. That's probably not going to happen because as societies become more affluent, more stable, they tend to have smaller families. You see this in extreme ways in Japan, even in China, because of the the one-child rule, a disastrous rule for China. But they have stagnant populations now. And the U.S. likewise. You know, we still have a relatively young country. We still have reasonable immigration. But, you know, it could be better in the sense that if you want growth, you have to have open borders. You have to let people in. You have to let money in. And so I think that the countries that understand that and gear their policies towards openness and towards encouraging business are going to do better than those that do not. But having said all that, there is no magic wand that we can wave, because a lot of the technological changes that occurred 100 years ago, electrification and, you know, the whole advent of the radio and the semiconductor and everything else, that's already baked in. And most of the inventions you see today are really incremental add-ons to these existing new technologies. They're not new anymore, in fact. So I think that's the challenge, is how do you get growth that could help you manage your debt load if most of the major factors are against you? And the answer is you can't. You know, population is the most important single factor when it comes to estimating future growth for a country. And as I say, the U.S. is at 0.5 now. After World War II, we were at 2% growth, which is enormous. All those soldiers came home, they got married, they made babies. So, you know, that spike in the baby boom was a function of war. And unless you think we're going to have another war sometime soon, I doubt you're going to see that again.
We touched on your first book, Inflated, which you wrote with Nouriel Roubini in 2010. You wrote another book called Financial Stability with Frederick Feldkamp in 2014, which is a roadmap that uses history to sort of explain what we can expect from future economic events. Those are both very contemporaneous books. They're history-driven, but they're about what's going on right now. It's curious to me, your latest book, which I'd like to focus on next, Ford Men, written this year in 2017, is not really a reflection on current economic events. It's the history of Ford Motor Company going back almost 100 years ago. Why the change in direction? And give us give our listeners a rundown of what they can expect to find in the book.
Well, Ford Man was actually my first book. But when I completed most of the research and the writing 12 years ago, Ford was in a lot of trouble. Bill Ford had to fire Jack Nasser and take over the company. And he really wasn't an operator. He represented the Ford family, which still controls the company, but in no way, shape, or form was he qualified to run the firm. But fortunately, in 2006, a couple of members of the board helped him hire Alan Mulally from Boeing. And Mulally wasn't a car guy, but he was a really good operator and a great leader. And he was able to come in and turn the company around. So I figured, okay, I have a decent endpoint for the book, and the book runs through the end of last year. But it was intended primarily to remind Americans that there are many, many other people in the Ford story besides Henry Ford. You know, Henry Ford did not do all of this on his own. In fact, he was a lot like Steve Jobs. He was a brilliant but dysfunctional human being. And, you know, people like James Cousins, who really turned Ford from an inspiration into an enterprise, and Charles Sorensen, the great engineer who was at Ford for 40 years, and he invented the assembly line, not Henry Ford. But you don't see any of this at the Ford Museum, because the PR department at Ford had airbrushed a history, so you just think it's all Henry. Henry wasn't even an officer of the company when it was founded, because he had such a horrible reputation in the business community in Detroit at the turn of the last century. So I thought, you know, let's go remind everyone of the biographers and the people who used to track Ford, people like James Galbraith, who loved to write about Ford. He called Henry Ford an appalling mechanic and had a lot of other interesting things to say. But, you know, more than anything else, the real takeaway, I think, from Ford is that deliberate purpose and design are fine in business, but luck is really important, too. Because if you think of it, you know, Ford Motor Company was run like a plantation. Henry Ford ran the place for almost 50 years. When the family took over after his death, there were no financial records. They had to hire Robert McNamara and the Whiz Kids to come in and try to reconstruct a financial picture of the company. And on the other hand, we have General Motors, which was held up as a prototypical corporation, rational management, the whole bit. they filed bankruptcy three times in the last century. Ford has never filed bankruptcy. And I think part of the reason is that the Ford family are tough. Billy Ford is a very tough, very focused individual. And I think it's also luck. I mean, how on earth could Ford have survived were it not for the fact that they were lucky?
Chris, we're just coming up on our time limit here, so we're going to have to wrap this up. But before we go, please let our listeners know where we can follow your work. I know that you did write a piece on Bitcoin recently. We've got a link to that in the Research Roundup email, or I'm sure people can find it from following you on Twitter. Give us your Twitter handle and where people can find out more about your work.
My website is rcwhalen, WHALEN.com, and the Twitter handle is the same, rcwhalen. I also have a number of papers up on the Social Science Network. That's where I put the long-haired stuff. And I write for Zero Hedge and a variety of other publications, National Interest, and the American Conservative. I do long articles for them. I have a piece on the big banks and crony capitalism, which is going to come out in September. So that'll be a lot of fun.
We'll send a link to your website to our registered users in the Research Roundup email, so folks, you can look for it there. Chris, thanks so much for a fantastic interview. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, what a great interview with Chris Whalen. One thing that stood out for me is obviously he's a big picture thinker, and he's looking at the situation with the bonds and the levels of private debt, and he sees a lot of the same problems that so many of our other guests see, but he takes a very tapered approach. He doesn't think it all is going to unravel at the seams here on the short term. So it's interesting to see someone that sees the problems but doesn't think that they're going to manifest all immediately on the short term. What was your takeaway from the interview?
I agree with that, and I think it's reflected in his view on the equity market. Very, very clear, decisive position of markets are way overvalued, and then very quick to say that doesn't mean they're about to crash. Things that are overvalued can get more overvalued, and I think that's the theme we've heard from quite a few guests. I certainly agree with it, despite the volatility that we saw this afternoon. You know, we're in what is still an uptrend, and I do think that the market cycle is very long in the tooth, but as he says, it doesn't mean that it has to all come falling apart tomorrow.
All right, well, moving on here. Well, we got a huge amount of favorable responses to our extended post-game segment last week when we discussed the future of cryptocurrencies. One of our listeners in Australia observed that while we hear your short-term market views and the market wrap each week, and then we see all the in-depth interview with the featured guests, which often goes into the guest's investment process, we never get around to hearing your own investment process, the investing principles and philosophies of so forth that you use. And I thought that was an excellent point. And so I was thinking that we could go into the understanding more about how you look at the markets in this week's post-game segment. So where do we start here, Eric?
Well, you know, I'll tell you a story that maybe will introduce why I think we should talk about Trading Edge as a starting point. I meet people all the time that have gotten started in trading. They don't really have a plan. They don't have any edge. They don't understand why they're losing money hand over fist. Usually they're Forex traders. So I ask them, why are you trading Forex? Well, because I read a book, and really, really famous people that have been very successful, like George Soros, trade Forex. So I figure I want to be like the good guys. So what I say to them is, okay, why are you trading in the first place? Is this about making money? And they say, oh yeah, it's all about making money. I say, well, do you want to know a surefire way to double your money overnight? You can turn $1 million into $2 million in 24 hours. And they say, are you serious? Really? How? And I say, it's simple. All you have to do, look up the agent for one of these prizefighter guys, Evander Holyfield or whoever. I don't even know who's in these days. I don't follow boxing. Challenge him to a fight, go in the ring, kick his ass, collect the prize money. You double your money. And they look at me horrified and say, well, Eric, what are you talking about? If I go into the ring with Evander Holyfield, he's going to kick my ass. And I say, okay, hold that thought. In the case of the sport of boxing, you intuitively get it. You understand that it's a competitive sport, and it doesn't make sense to get in the ring unless you know that there's some reason that you have a chance of winning. So you know better than to even think about it. But in the case of trading, you don't seem to intuitively recognize that it's a competitive sport, and it never makes sense to get in the ring unless you have an edge and you know what that edge is. But you don't want to stop there. You don't want to stop at getting into a boxing ring without knowing how to box. You want to get into the boxing ring with a prize fighter, with, in this case, George Soros. So you're trading Forex. Now, look, do you understand why George Soros trades Forex? People who are that big, whose trades can move markets, usually end up trading a lot of Forex because it's the biggest, most liquid market in the world, and it can absorb their huge trade sizes, where if they traded small cap stocks, one trade could, you know, materially move the market. So why in the world would you climb into the ring in the hardest game that there is? Because currencies are probably the hardest thing to get right in terms of macro, in terms of how much you need to understand in order to get it right. Do you know more about George Soros than the currency pairs that he trades? Do you have better contacts than he does? You know, why are you getting into the hardest market that there is? And, you don't have to. You could use your size to your advantage and go to the local gym and fight with somebody like yourself who doesn't know how to fight. But you want to climb in the ring with George Soros. That's what I hear when you tell me that you're trading Forex. And they say, oh, I never thought about it that way. So the moral of the story is you have to have an edge. If you're going to trade, don't do it unless you know what that edge is. There's a lot of ways to gain an edge. I call this the Schwager Doctrine. What you have to do is figure out what approach to trading, how you can gain an edge in a way that suits your personality, because what's right for me and what's right for you are going to be two different things. You need to figure out what kind of resonates with your personality, what style of trading. The best way that I know to do that is to read Jack Schwager. Market Wizards books. It's an absolutely fantastic compendium of in-depth, long-form interviews with the very best, most successful traders in the world. And if you read those books, you'll begin to identify with some of the characters there. In my case, as I was reading various different articles, I really resonated with the style of somebody like a Jim Rogers, who's very much a fundamental-driven trader. He doesn't even think of himself as a trader. He calls himself an investor because he doesn't like to focus on short-term trading. There's other guys that are just chart guys who ignore the fundamentals. You've got to figure out what resonates for you. And then you need to learn until you're sure that you've gained some kind of edge. It doesn't make sense to get in the ring and start trading until you know what you're doing. And that could mean taking a course like you offer, Patrick, in options and learning about option trading. It could be a lot of things. It could be learning macro. Start out by reading the stories of very successful traders and figure out what style and approach resonates with your personality, and then learn about it before you do anything.
Now, Eric, you're giving some excellent advice here for sure. Question at the beginning is sort of to asking about you yourself, how Eric Townsend personally approaches investing, and what is your philosophy? Now, you talked about here the idea of focusing on an edge, about having this edge. And so why don't you elaborate a little bit on how you personally approach this with your fund and where you find your edge in trading?
Well, the Schwager Doctrine led me to macro. When I first got involved as a full-time private investor, I knew I had to learn a lot about this, and I thought it was going to be Graham and Dodd style, analyze balance sheets, and I was not particularly drawn to that. It doesn't resonate with my personality. When I figured out that you can learn about what makes the world work and what geopolitical interactions are going to affect markets and why an earthquake in Chile means the price of copper might rise, that just was so fascinating to me that I really became addicted to it. And that led me eventually to adopt two core themes, two macro themes, which have captured my attention. And they're very long-term overarching themes that just sort of frame the way that I think about the world. The first one is peak cheap oil. And peak cheap oil, I distinguish from peak oil. A lot of people in the peak oil camp used to talk about the world getting to a point where there wouldn't be enough oil and we'd have some dystopian future and there'd be shortages and, you know, crisis and so forth. That's nonsense. There will always be enough oil. But the point is, the cheap and easy stuff where you just drill a hole in the ground and oil comes out. That's all been discovered and exploited. There's no more left. We're out of that. We're at the point now where shale oil, if you use these advanced technologies of horizontal drilling and hydraulic fracturing, is delivering what's actually become a glut of oil. And that glut, I expect, will continue. But the point is, the only way we got to the glut was to develop expensive technology that dramatically increases the cost of production way above the old $10 a barrel that it was possible to produce conventional oil for. So we're producing non-conventional. Eventually, the shale oil boom is going to peter out. We will have drilled up the countryside like Swiss cheese. All of those shale assets are going to be depleted, and we're going to have to move back to tar sands and deep water offshore and so forth. And again, it just means that the cost of energy over time, it's going to come in waves. It gets more expensive as you have to move into a new technology like shale drilling. Then the industry gets good at shale drilling, as they have, and the cost of shale drilling comes down, as it has. That's leading to the current glut. Eventually, shale is going to play out. The next thing will be deep water offshore. It's very expensive at first. Eventually, some of those processes will be automated and it'll get cheaper, but it won't get as cheap as shale was. And each successive wave is going to mean higher and higher energy costs. So that's one of the things that just sort of frames my thinking. It does not mean that I'm betting that the price of oil has to go up. Quite to the contrary, in 2014 and 15, I've made a fair amount of profits shorting crude oil because I was able to understand the shale glut and what had caused it because I've spent so much time studying peak cheap oil and understanding different oil production technologies and so forth. The second big overarching theme that I think about is the inevitable reset of the international monetary system that I think has to come in our lifetimes. I don't know when. And what I mean by the reset of the IMS is that the whole system is based on the U.S. dollar serving as the world's reserve currency. Why is the world's reserve currency the U.S. dollar? Well, it was chosen because of its solid credit and convertibility to gold way back in 1944. The gold standard has basically been defaulted on. We no longer have convertibility of U.S. dollars into gold. And we've seen a whole bunch of reckless spending and borrowing and an accumulation of $20 trillion of debt. So eventually, just as Robert Triffin predicted, and we talked about this last week. You know, why was I able to do our post game last week without doing any particular research in preparation for that conversation last week? It's because I spend a lot of time thinking about how the international monetary system eventually has to go through a reset where the U.S. dollar in its current form is no longer the world's reserve currency and the preferred central bank reserve asset. So that's why I think about these things and why the conversation that we had in last week's postgame kind of came naturally to me is because I focus on those high-level themes. Neither one of those things, though, really yields any direct tradable, you know, think about peak cheap oil. If you just said you believe this peak cheap oil idea, that would suggest you go long crude oil futures expecting the cost of production to increase over time. If you want to make money trading, you've got to narrow down and look much more closely at what's going on in the market today, not what's going to happen over the next 20 years. So those two themes drive everything that I do, but it's not about oil prices going up. It's not about treasuries crashing or the U.S. dollar crashing. As I mentioned earlier, I've made money shorting oil, and I've made money being long U.S. dollar futures. Even though those trades seem to be at odds with my long-term views, they're not at odds with what I see going on in the market right now. And the reason I'm able to see what I see in the market is because I think so much about the long-term that it helps me to sort out the medium to short term. One of the things that I figured out, though, is that although that motivation of thinking about macro is kind of what keeps me going, what is fascinating to me, what drives me to spend time thinking about markets, if you're running other people's money in a fund or if you're doing this full-time as a full-time private investor, you need trades, not just long-term themes. And there are ways that you gain edge for trading that are completely different from gaining an edge in the sense of a long-term informed worldview about something like the reform of the IMS or peak cheap oil.
So, Eric, you start with an overarching view. The world is based on two core themes that drive your macro thinking, peak cheap oil and the inevitable reset of the international monetary system, eventually displacing that U.S. dollar as the world's reserve currency. But let's not stop there. You said you actually generate trading strategies using different kind of edge. Please elaborate on that.
Well, the best trades always come from the identification of tradable market inefficiencies. Now, let me explain exactly what I mean by that. There's this idea called the efficient markets hypothesis that says basically everything's always priced in based on all freely available public information. The market will discount that information. It's already priced into the market. Frankly, I think that's nonsense to say that that's the way things really work in all markets all the time. But to some extent, it is true most of the time. The markets are fairly efficient. What you have to look for is where are there inefficiencies in the market? Arbitrage is the ideal example of that. If you can find the same thing priced differently in two different markets, you buy it in one market, sell it in the other market, pocket the difference, and you do it without taking any risk. And that's how the hedge fund industry began, is there were a lot of tradable market inefficiencies that people were able to find and exploit, and there weren't that many people chasing after them, so it was fairly within reach to find them. These days, the big boys are looking so hard to find those tradable inefficiencies that it is extremely difficult to find a true market inefficiency which is suitable for trading in size by a major player, such as a major hedge fund or prop desk. Now, I just said something really important there, that is suitable for trading in size. And what I do is I try to gain my edge by looking at, okay, I know I cannot realistically compete at finding tradable market inefficiencies that are suitable for trading in size. And by in size, I mean running billions of dollars as the large hedge funds are doing. If it cannot be traded in size, those guys are going to overlook it. So where there's smaller trades that work, but they are not attractive to the big funds for some reason, those are the ones that are going to be overlooked and where there's a chance of me actually finding them. So the whole trick is looking for what kinds of areas I can find trades that work for me, but I don't have to compete with people that are smarter than me, because for some reason, those trades don't appeal to those people that are smarter than me. So in order for them to appeal to those people who are smarter than me, and by that I mean large hedge funds, prop desks, institutions, and so forth, they have to be able to trade them in size if you're running hundreds of millions or billions of dollars. And they have to also meet street expectations about time horizon, volatility, and so forth. One of the things that really comes into play, I think, is time horizon can be a private trader's best friend, because funds have to focus on the fact that they're delivering a monthly tear sheet. They've got to deliver monthly returns. That means that the time horizon for their trades has to be a matter of days or weeks. They can't put a trade on that they're real sure is going to pay off 3 years from now, but they don't know what's going to happen in terms of the ups and downs between now and then, because it adds too much volatility to their portfolio, and that's what they get measured on. So I call this not fighting City Hall. You know, if you are an extra on a movie set, you don't compete with John Travolta, that's the big hedge funds. You don't compete with Travolta for chicks on the movie set. You take the throwbacks instead. And I think that in my case, the place where I particularly just found a niche was term structure, understanding the shape of the term structure, forward strip as some people call it, in commodity markets. Now, first to explain what this means, if you look at stocks, the price of a given stock, you know, it's whatever it is, and it goes up and down, and that's just, there's only one number. If you look at a commodity like crude oil, there's a price for delivery in September, there's a price for delivery in October, there's a price for delivery in November, December, and January, and February, and so forth. So there are different prices based on the delivery month. When I was learning about commodities, this is about 10, 12 years ago, I met a guy in New York, Wall Street veteran named Larry. And out of respect for his privacy, I won't tell you his last name. And he had taught me quite a bit about markets as I was coming up to speed and trying to gear myself up to become a full-time private investor. And when I asked him about term structure, I got a very simple answer. He says, well, and he was this New York guy, so he talked like this. He says, Eric, let me tell you about term structure. If it's in backwardation, that means there's a shortage of something. And if it's in contango, there's limits to how far that can go, because somebody could arbitrage with buying the storage. In other words, if there is a contango, meaning that each successive month is priced higher than the next one, there's a limit to how much the contango can go, because at some point, somebody's just going to buy something, store it, pay to insure it, pay to store it, and sell it forward. So it can only get to a certain point. And that was the end of the story. And this guy had taught me so much about other things. And I said, well, Larry, you know, when I learned about technical analysis, I look at a price chart of stocks. There's this idea of patterns in the chart, head and shoulders patterns and wedge patterns and so forth. Do those come into play on these term structure charts? And he says, yeah, Eric, I've been in the business more than 40 years. I never heard of anybody paying attention to that. And when Larry told me that, Patrick, it felt like I was just mentally channeling Jim Rogers, who I hadn't at the time met yet. And I remembered reading about things that he'd written as well as his interviews in the Market Wizards books. And I just thought, something that nobody else bothers to look at. And I started thinking about this and I thought it through and I said, wait a minute, what is the commodity term structure really? It's exactly the same thing as the yield curve that a lot of people pay attention to, except that the yield curve is basically the commodity term structure for the commodity of money itself. If I look at money that has to be delivered at various different times in the future, that's the maturity of different loans or different bonds. If there's different yields on those, different prices, that's basically the term structure of borrowed money. So if you wanted to go to Wall Street and make a name for yourself by being smarter than everybody else, Patrick, and knowing more about the yield curve than anybody else does, you've got some pretty darn steep competition. Try doing this. Go to Google and do it. Put in a Google search for yield curve PhD thesis. You'll get hundreds of thousands of hits. There's a whole lot of people that know more than you do about the yield curve. We'll now go and look at all the other commodities other than money, whether it be crude oil or wheat or soybeans or whatever. Try doing that same Google search for commodity term structure PhD thesis and see what you find. There's not very much there. And for some reason, learning about the shape of the commodity term structure doesn't seem to entice nearly as many people as are enticed to learn all about the yield curve. And I started thinking, okay, why is that? Well, I figured it out. The answer goes back to what we talked about just a minute ago. It's the attractiveness of trading strategies to people who have to trade in size. If what you can do is figure out that the shape of that forward curve is misshaped so that the crude oil futures in, I don't know, October of 2019 are mispriced from where they should be, and the curve is going up instead of going down, and you want to put a trade on because you know it's going to revert before those things get to maturity into the direction that you can predict. How is it possible that I could be learning about this stuff and figuring it out on my own, and I don't seem to be competing with a lot of smarter than me people? Well, the answer is, when you deal with long-dated commodity futures, there's not enough liquidity. People who are trading billions of dollars can't put on those term structure trades because the long-dated side of the spread trade is not going to have enough liquidity on to put the trade on in the kind of size that the really big boys need it to be. So what I've done in the last several years is I've really focused most of my energy becoming as expert as I can on the term structure of commodity futures, but particularly of crude oil. And the reason that I focus specifically on that is I've kind of found this comfortable niche where it's more complex than the average retail trader would be able to figure out, so I'm not competing with them. But the people who are more able than I am to figure it out, which are the very sophisticated institutional traders and hedge funds, they're not dealing with crude oil futures more than a year out or so because there's not enough liquidity in them to trade at the size that they are. So I'm using my smaller size to my advantage. And I'll be the first to admit, although I've had some good success trading this strategy, between my personal accounts and the fund that I manage, I'm still running less than $25 million. So I have the ability to trade these longer dated things. If I was running $1 billion, the strategies that I use wouldn't work because I wouldn't be able to buy into the longer dated contracts without moving the market in a way that would undermine my trading efficiency. And this is a very well-known phenomenon. You know, a lot of people would say, well, the financial theory of efficient markets hypothesis, all these things tell us that it's impossible to beat the market. That's not true. What is true is it's extremely impossible to beat the market in size. If you're running hundreds of millions of or billions of dollars, it is extremely difficult to find those inefficiencies because you need to be trading very liquid assets. If you can trade not so liquid assets that the big boys don't touch because there isn't enough liquidity, now you're competing primarily with smaller traders, and it's a lot easier to succeed there. And that's the reason that Ray Dalio is such an iconic figure in the hedge fund industry. The fact that, you know, if you look at Dalio's returns, he makes about 20% a year on average, net of fees returned to his investors. That's a good return, but it's not you know, amazing, spectacular. There's a lot of hedge funds that have made even better performance than that, considerably better performance. They're not running $40 billion or whatever the number is that Bridgewater is running. And, you know, that's the reason Dalio is super duper famous. So, you know, if you're in the business of being a major fund manager, you have challenges that smaller guys don't have. When you're a smaller guy, you don't want to get this hero worship thing for the big guys and say, let me be like George Soros and trade currencies. What you want to do is say, what are the asset classes that the big boys cannot invest in because there's not enough liquidity in them, or where something else doesn't meet their criteria, such as the volatility or the time horizon? Use those things to your advantage. And that's basically been the key ingredient to my success, is looking for ways where I can do things that other people don't do because they're bigger than me. People who are smarter than me can't do the trades I'm doing because they're running too much money to do the same trades that I'm doing.
So, Eric, you feel that understanding the trading and the term structure of crude oil futures markets is more opportune place for you to gain that edge, and rather than making those directional trades in the actual price of crude oil where you have much stiffer competition. But let's dive in a little bit deeper in the subject. So please explain further to our listeners what you're talking about when you say you trade the term structure rather than the outright price of that oil futures.
Well, this is one of those pictures worth a million words stories, Patrick. So I think we need to look at a chart, and we have a link in your research roundup email to download a graph that I'm going to talk to next. The term structure, again, is a chart that shows what is the price for the prompt delivery. That's, you know, the September delivery is the current front month in West Texas Intermediate crude oil futures. And then what's the price for October, November, December, January, February, and so forth. Right now, that chart is a little bit boring if we took today's. It's just a straight line contango. So let's go back to May 24th. And I picked that day just because it was right after OPEC had made some announcements where they were trying to jawbone the market. If we look at the May 24th West Texas Intermediate crude oil term structure, which is the chart that you have the link to in your research roundup, look at those first few months. And actually, take a second without even trying to interpret the markups that I've put on in the little bullets there. You know, just look at that chart. What does it say to you? Probably nothing. It's a dipsy doodle. It goes up at first, and then it goes down for a while, and then it goes up towards the end there. Well, why is it doing those things? Did you ever think about that? Here's my experience. Very, very few people, even professional oil traders, really think in detail about what causes the shape of that term structure to be what it is. In fact, I've had to make up my own terminology to describe some of the patterns that tend to exist in these charts because I can't find any book or, you know, credible source of knowledge. And I certainly don't think that I'm the only guy who's smart enough to know about this stuff. I'm sure there's lots of people who know a lot more about it than I do. But they're not writing books about it. This is not stuff that you can find in the investing, aisle at your local Barnes & Noble. So if you see what's going on there at the beginning of the chart on the left-hand side, those first 4 or 5 months, it's an uphill motion. Each subsequent month is priced higher than the one before. Now, when you see that right at the left edge of the term structure chart, it's what I call a storage beak, and I just named it a beak because it looks like a bird's beak to me. Totally made it up myself. Nobody else calls it that. Then after that, it goes into backwardation, which is where it starts to go downhill for a while. And eventually, there's kind of a big bowl-shaped bottom, and then it eventually starts going uphill for a while. Well, why does it do these things? The reason I call that a storage beak on the left side is that the first few months are going to be influenced more than anything else by the demand for storage. If there's a need to store oil because there's too much of it and there's an oversupply, as is the case in today's market, then the first several months are going to be in contango, meaning increasing price over time. Why? Because the market is basically needs to be in that structure in order to create an incentive for the people who store oil to do so. Because the way the storage guys make a buck is they're buying the front month, they're putting it in a tank, they're selling the 2 or 3 months out contract on the very same day that they bought the front month. So they're locking in a price, and whatever that price differential is what they're going to get paid as rent for the use of their storage tank for that 2 or 3 month period. So the first few months are going to be a reflection of how much demand there is for storage more than anything else. If there is a backwardation, if it's a downhill from the very first contract forward, as we had back before, say, the middle of 2014, that means there's not enough oil and there's no demand for storage. But in an environment like we have today where there's a need to store oil, at least the first few months are likely to be in contango. Then we get to what I've labeled the peak there on the chart. At some point, there is a peak in the term structure, a high point. And I've got a number of different strategies that have to do with how many months there are until we get to that peak. As you see in the contract now, going back to May 24th, the high month looks to be about December of 2017. It's usually what will happen as you go forward in time, that same month stays at the top of the hill there, and you just, as contracts expire, you've got less dots to the left of it, but the same month stays at the top of the hill because that's where the market thinks there's going to be a rebalancing and we're going to shift into a structural backwardation when we get to that point. And at some point, as you get closer to it, the market figures out, oh, we're not really going to have that rebalancing after all. And there's a shift, and several months at a time kind of fall off from being in an uphill and into a downhill. And now you've got a new peak month, which is shifted 3 or 4 months to the right. Now, that doesn't necessarily happen. That only happens if the market is surprised and finds out that there's actually a greater need for storage than there was previously. Now, how many times, listeners, has anybody explained to you how storage is influencing the shape of this chart? Probably not a lot. I don't know of any book about this. I've had to figure this stuff out by talking to traders and just experimenting with it. So why then, after that peak, is there a backwardation, which means the prices are declining for several months? Well, there's a couple of things going on. One is what I call a hedge bowl. You see where I have the chart labeled as a hedge bowl. What I, generally speaking, about 2 years out into the term structure is where the oil producers in the shale patch have to hedge their forward production in order to satisfy their financiers. So they're selling those 2 years out crude oil futures, and there aren't a lot of natural buyers 2 years out. So that's depressing it. And where exactly they're selling on the curve, it's not always exactly in 1 month. So it tends to create that bowl-shaped depression. Why is there, though, that almost linear backwardation that occurs from, say, the end of 2017 all the way to through 2018? It really looks like from December 2017 to December 2018, we're seeing a pretty significant backwardation there. Well, this particular chart is a snapshot of the term structure just after OPEC had gone out of their way to make a couple of announcements. One is they said they're extending their production cut. That pushes up the short-term prices, and that's what causes the peak price at the end of 2017 to be as high as it is. But then they went out of their way to say, when this 9 months is up, folks, that's going to be it. And in the second half of 2018, we're going to go back to producing all the oil that we can. That, we think, was intentional on OPEC's part because they wanted to create exactly this term structure. They wanted to create an expectation that there would be a glut of oil returning to the market in the second half of 2018, pushing those latter half of 2018 prices down. Why would OPEC want prices to be down? They want the near-term prices, what they're getting paid for their oil, to be up, while they, at the same time, want to push down the further out prices that are close to the hedging window where the U.S. shale producers are forced to do their hedging in order to meet the requirements of their financing contracts. So OPEC had just put a bunch of effort into that. And as soon as I saw this particular term structure, I said, that backwardation is not going to stay there. We're going to get to a reality point where the market figures out that OPEC cannot engineer that backwardation into the market just by jawboning it. And we're going to get back to a straight contango structure. So in that case, the trade was short the December of 2017 crude oil contract, long the December of 2018. So you're not exposed to the outright price of oil. Whether the price of oil goes up or down isn't important. What's important is whether or not the 2017 December price stays that much higher than the 2018 price, or if it actually reverts and inverts, as was my prediction, to the point where the 17 price is lower than the December of 18 price. Now, that's exactly what happened, was that whole backwardation came completely out of the market so that we're into straight contango with every successive month priced higher than the one before it. And it was fairly easy for me to see that that was the most likely thing to happen. So I put that trade on, which is I expect there to be backwardation. In that particular one, where we're going only about 15 months out, it's fairly easy. There's a lot of liquidity in that December of 2018 contract. You start doing that further out to December of 19. Now there's a lot less liquidity in those longer dated contracts, and it's harder for the really big players to trade them because their trades would move the market too much. So just understanding this structure, understanding why the shape of the curve is what it is, and looking for trades that I can make, not on the outright price of oil, which so many people are competing with very, very talented people that have better information than me as to which way the price of oil is going. I just look at, okay, OPEC engineered this backwardation. I don't think it's going to last. I'm going to bet that it will go away. And I can place that bet with a spread trade without having to know whether or not the outright price of oil is going up or down. I just think that the shape of the curve is going to change. And again, how many people know how to look at this chart and know what forces are affecting different parts of the shape of the curve? Certainly, there are plenty of people that know a lot more about this than I do, but they're not writing books about it. It's not something that's available to the public. It's something you've got to figure out. And so my advice, it's not to tell our listeners, you know, go and learn as I have about, you know, term structure of crude oil. I got so interested in the term structure of crude oil because I'm fascinated by the long-term picture of peak cheap oil. What fascinates you? What drives you? What are you passionate about? And is there something that you can learn about where you find something like I've found in the shape of the term structure where there aren't that many people trading it, and the people who are trading it, and oftentimes the ones who are smarter than me, are limited in their ability to trade it because of liquidity problems that exist in the longer dated contracts.
You know, Eric, that really resonates with me because, you know, when I train traders to do that, a lot of people come into a program and they have that attitude that it's, you know, I want to learn to trade like Warren Buffett. But, you know, Warren Buffett has a lot of limitations. When you're trading billions upon billions of dollars, you can't have the flexibility to adjust positions without everyone in the market knowing what you're doing. While if you're a small beginning trader, you have a lot of room to take advantage of the fact that you're small and that you're no one knows when you're going in and out of the market. And so what you're sharing with us here is the idea that, you know, you focus your trading strategies where you can get an advantage, you know, where in this oil market, there's a capacity limited trades out there that there these big players can't really come in there and outgun you, you know, and that really makes so much sense. So what is it else that you do to develop an edge for these trades?
Well, the next thing that I focus on after just picking something like term structure that not a lot of people specialize in is to focus on where Wall Street is stricken by their own models and ideas about how things work. One major opportunity there is time horizon, as I mentioned earlier. Big funds, professional investors have to focus on their monthly returns. This is a very short-sighted industry. They can't put on a trade that has a time horizon of 2 years and they have no idea whether it's going to lose money or make money this month or next month. They've got to know that it's going to make money this month and next month, or they don't want the trade. So if you can use that to your advantage, you know, assume that the trade that you can put on that lasts for a week or so, you've got really serious competition for. There's not much competition in those longer term trades that might take 6 months to 5 years in order to play out. So a longer time horizon means less competition from professional traders, and particularly the most savvy and sophisticated professional traders who are running hedge funds that have to produce a monthly tear sheet. A controversial version of that same idea is finding logical holes and fallacies in the academic finance framework, which all of this stuff is measured by. Now, I am definitely deviating from accepted what, you know, a professor of finance would tell you is how the world works. I'll tell you how I think the world works. There is a belief in the industry that volatility essentially equals risk. And the theoretical basis for this is if you had normally distributed returns, in other words, if returns on trades are in fact random, because the efficient market hypothesis is actually true, which I don't think it is, then if you have a truly random distribution of returns, volatility in that stream of returns is a proxy for risk. And that is a very academically defensible. People write all kinds of papers about this with Greek letters and all this stuff, and it looks cool in finance departments in major universities. It leads to one of the most important metrics that are used to measure the performance of hedge funds and other speculative trading strategies, which is called a Sharpe ratio. Sharpe ratio is measuring performance adjusted for risk, is what they'll tell you. That's nonsense. It's adjusted for volatility, and they call it risk adjusted because they are making the assumption that volatility and risk are the same thing. Now, to debunk the idea that volatility and risk are the same thing, let's consider a possible investment strategy. Patrick, a guy like you who understands options can launch a fund. You can go and write and lever up as much as you possibly can out of the money, both put and call options on the major stock indices, S&P 500, Dow, what have you, and collect all those premiums. Because all of those options, if they're far out of the money, are going to always expire worthless. And you keep all the money, and you're going to have a really great-looking Sharpe ratio because you always keep all the money in the end. There's a little bit of volatility along the way, but everything always goes fine. Just one little problem with that, which is if there's a market crash, you not only lose 100% of all of your money in about an hour, but you can actually get underwater to the point where by the time your broker liquidates all of your positions, you end up owing money, potentially millions of dollars of owed money, because you got into a negative balance in all of these crazy positions. So if you take a strategy like that, you and I can clearly see it has huge, massive risk. But that risk is concentrated and what professionals call tail risk. It's only the outlier case of a major market move up or down that triggers that risk. And the rest of the time, you're going to have a really attractive Sharpe ratio because you have low volatility. So volatility doesn't really equal risk in the real world. But the thing is, for right or for wrong, the industry measures it as if it does. What that means is if you can find a trade which in your analysis doesn't really have an extraordinary risk, but it is subject to a lot of volatility, professional traders are not going to be competing with you for that trade. They're going to pass on that one. They're going to say, too much vol. And even if they are smart enough to understand that that vol is not really representative of true risk, they know that the people that are measuring their performance are going to consider that volatility as an indication of undue risk, and they're going to stay away from the trade. So long time horizon, or if you can find a high volatility trade that is actually low risk in the long run, but just happens to experience volatility along the way, the street's not going to touch it because of that volatility. Now, be careful, because a lot of times volatility really is a proxy for risk. You don't want to be going and looking for high volatility trades, but you do want to be looking for low risk trades that someone else might pass over because of a higher vol characteristic than is really representative of the risk that's inherent to the trade. And that's one of the strategies that I've used very successfully is some of the strategies that I have. I don't think they have a huge risk. I've done a lot of modeling. I've bought a lot of years and years of crude oil data and looked at where time spreads and crude oil futures end up and what the probabilities of my trades going wrong. And I say that my risk is really not so bad. But there is a lot of volatility in those strategies, and that means other people are not going to be competing with me and pricing me out of the market because they're going to pass on that high volatility trading strategy. We're definitely running over again, so thanks for your patience this week. I think just to wrap this up quickly, it really is, I never would have learned about the term structure of West Texas Intermediate crude oil futures if I were not driven by a passion for understanding the future of the planet and how peak cheap oil is going to play into it. So the first rule is Schwager doctrine. doctrine. Find your passion. Find out what drives you, what's going to lead you to have the energy and motivation to want to learn all about something. And then look to use size and things like volatility and time horizon to your advantage. Look for places where you can trade, where the big boys are not going to be competing with you because there's something that doesn't meet their criteria. Don't fight them. As I said, take the throwbacks. Don't compete for chicks with John Travolta. It's not going to work.
Oh, that's perfect. All right. Well, thanks, Eric. And I hope all our listeners enjoy what was probably Macro Voice's first time visiting your own investment trading strategy and approach. Now, folks, please let us know whether you like this week's post-game segment on Twitter or by replying to the Research Roundup emails. Eric, anything else you wanted to add before we close up this week's show?
Well, I just want to pick up on a point you made earlier, Patrick. We really need a favor here, folks. We work really hard to bring you this show every week. It's free, and we do need your help. We don't need your money, but we do need your help. So take those few minutes, rate and review us on iTunes so that we can stay in the top 100 business podcast list, gain more listeners, and that empowers Patrick to sign up even more guests. The other thing you can do is forward your research roundups, tell your friends about us, donate if you can in order to help us defray our production costs, but most importantly, register your free account at macrovoices.com. You get the free weekly research roundup email, which is a compendium of links to all the coolest stuff that we could find on the internet, including things like the chart that we just discussed, as well as downloads from our interview guests. Patrick, tell them what's in this week's research roundup.
All right. Well, our listeners will find the transcript for today's interview with Chris. Also, the link to that term structure chart that you referenced to in this post game. There's also a link to an article from Bank of America Merrill Lynch suggesting that there are more zombie banks in Europe today than there were in the pre-Lehman times. I thought that was a really interesting kind of perspective on the consequences of Mario Draghi's money printing. As well, there's a further article commenting on why a deeply flawed Western economic models are undermining the worst global recovery in history. So you'll find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup. So that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners and are always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we'll include it in our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at Macro Voices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com. And we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna, shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.